Thanks to the amazing Jenny Green. She's back with you tomorrow at 3 p.m. to kickstart the weekend. It's Thursday, the 17th of September, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, Zlatan and friends bring champagne football to Tala, but can Shamrock Rovers cause an upset?
But that's what you want to do. You want to go and test yourself against the best teams, and they're going to come over to Tala, and you know, people are going to see how, going to be looking to see how we get on against such a good side, because you know, we've been playing well this year and we've been doing well and we believe in what we do. The manager has us set up good, so look, we'll go out there and give it a good go anyways.
Come on, Rovers. Speaking of champagne football, Mark Toy is in studio to discuss his new book on the FAI's free fall under John Delaney.
On legal advice, I'm precluded from making any further comments at this hearing in relation to the finances of the association or my former role as CEO or the 100,000 payment, either directly or indirectly. I am not in a position to answer any such questions here at this time.
Plus, we've Premier League transfer latest golf with Greg Allen as the US Open is underway, and we're building up to a huge rugby weekend for Leinster and Ulster and soccer weekend for the girls in green.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 and or tweet at Game On 2FM, and we'd love to hear from you. Marie, there's a load going on, and you mentioned the girls in green there. We have a fantastic competition. We have the opportunity not only to wish the girls the best of luck in the big match coming up, but also to be in with a chance to win a brilliant jersey. And it's a bit of class, Kate, isn't it?
It's absolutely fantastic. And it's signed as well.
Signed.
That's pretty amazing.
You always know the diehards, I felt, when it came to signing jerseys, because some people there, do you mind signing the back? And you're there, they're going to put a jacket on that and try to cover it up. The diehards sign it on the front.
What kind of a scribbler were you now on the jersey?
No, always try to make it legible as possible, but it's a big old D and an O and a C, so you get away.
Yeah.
I worked it into Don O'Cal. Like, I remember we used to go to signing sessions and I was so envious of Ben Kay. Like Ben Kay, so simple. And here's me with Donna O'Cala. And it's nearly an hour out of my day lost. But all you have to do to be able to chance of winning this fantastic Irish jersey is send the girls in green a short good luck video. Isn't that it?
Yeah. So tag Game on it as well.
Yeah. So it's on our Twitter page if you'd like to do it before 6 p.m. tomorrow, and we'll decide the winner from there.
I'm going to get my kids to enter even though they can't win, but just send a message.
Yeah, very true. That it's okay to send a message. Can I not win it?
No, like, but get the kids to enter it anyway.
But it's signed.
Just don't tell them they can't win. It'll be grand. And actually good news as well today, because the game on Saturday against Germany will be shown live on RTE2 and RTE Player as well. Peter Collins will be in studio and he'll be alongside Karen Duggan and Chloe Mustaki, who've had on this show very, very recently as well. And then Stephanie Roach will be alongside Dara Maloney on commentary. So it's great to see that game on television. So absolutely get your messages in and we will have a winner sometime tomorrow evening.
Absolutely. There's a bit of transfer news and I looked at it today. Your buddy Jurgen Klopp, I wouldn't like to play poker with him, Marie. He is some boy.
Yeah, well, he kind of made it fairly obvious without saying it straight out that he really wanted Thiago. He was trying to make a bit of a joke out of it, but he said he couldn't really play down the speculation. But I think there was no denying that he was the type of player that he wanted. It's reportedly, anyway, it's a done deal for around 30 million coming from Bayern Munich. He was supposed to be out of contract next summer, but they've decided to make their move for him. So it looks like it's going ahead anyway. So that'll be super news for Liverpool. There's a lot of excitement going around. I think their midfield, you know, it's been solid since Coutinho left in 2018, but I think they've been missing a bit of flair, and just from seeing the way that he plays for Bayern Munich, I think that he's the exact person that they need. He's got brilliant at the one-on-ones and letting the ball into the front three, and when you have a front three like that and someone that can get the ball into them pretty quickly, I think he'll be a really good addition. But it'll be a big battle then for midfield as well, which is something that you want, you know, always want that bit of competition. But it's really exciting to see him come in, and it'll be interesting now to see if Gini Wijnaldum ends up leaving as a result. But I think maybe the next 24 hours might tell a lot.
I'm always interested with players like that. Like, do they look at players like that to change formations. You know, the idea, when you get someone like that, can you think, all right, now we can play a different formation or style? Would you think that's the case?
Well, just going from where he came from, so he was at Barcelona and then he was in Bayern, so he's really comfortable playing that 4-3-3. So I'd imagine that that's kind of something that he will slot into, because, you know, that they have that solid three in the middle and then the three up front. But he, in the past, Pep Guardiola has said that he can play in three or four positions. So when you're bringing in somebody as versatile, but that was a few years ago when he's younger. He's 29 now, so I'm not sure if he'd have the capabilities to play in three or four positions, but he'd definitely be able to play in two positions anyway. But no, he's brilliant. Like, even the passing of his, of the ball, like, he has an ability to take out three or four players when he lays off a pass, and that'll be brilliant for the front three. So I think he could just add another dimension and another bit of excitement.
Speaking of older people, well, not older older people, but Gareth Bale, it seems like he's been around for ages and he's been linked with Spurs. And I don't know about you, but I just think he's, of course, there's been trouble with Madrid, but you only have such a short career, and to say sitting on your arse for it, I just think Gareth Bale needs to be playing.
I saw a brilliant tweet today. It was like Daniel Levy had signed his 27th player, Gareth Bale, to replace Gareth Bale, and it does feel like that. There's been so many sagas and so many people that had been brought in to replace him, and I don't think he's ever really been replaced. But like, you're dead right, Donica. At some stage, he's got to look at his achievements and what he, you know, what he's done with his career. And when you think of all the potential, the excitement, everything that Gareth Bale brought when he was playing in the Premier League, and that just seemed to dissipate over the years. And you know, you get glimpses of it every now and again, and he'll score a big goal in a big game, but when you're hearing the reports then of him, you know, not gelling with his teammates, and you're seeing celebration pictures and he's on the edge, like, what kind of an existence is that, you know? Yeah. Like, just living over there and playing golf and doing a bit of training. I mean, it sounds great. How do we get jobs like that?
How do we get there? There was Ulster Championship fixtures announced today, and the one that I was probably interested in, Marie, and we're already after getting texts in on it on to 51552, is No Clonus, because of the floodlights. And, yeah, and Eddie here has just made a very obvious point. Any chance you play the match at 1 o'clock?
Yeah, I don't know why the game is at 4 o'clock, but it seems that there will be probably a number of games on at that time, so around at that time, so they probably have to fit it in, because there is such a backlog of games. But it is disappointing. I think anyone that's been to Clonus for an Ulster final knows that it is one of those really, really special days, just going up through the, oh my gosh, should there be no crowds? I was going to say, going up through the town with all the crowds of people and the crack that you have. Oh, forget about it.
Eddie's worried about milking the cows. You didn't even worry about it, Eddie.
They should be. They should absolutely be taking that into account, because there is no fans. But look, there are some fantastic fixtures to come, and it's actually just great to get fixtures. We've been talking about Donegal and Tyrone coming up in Ballybofey, and I think that's one that's real standout one, especially, you know, kind of winner takes all these huge games now in the championship. And it's just going to be really interesting to see it get going, see what it's like without the fans, and see who comes out at the end of it at winter football. But it's a pity not to have Clonus, but I think at this stage we are where we are, Donica, and we're just going to have to get on with this.
No, you can't say that classic sports jargon. Yeah, it's a game of two halves, and we'll review it on Monday.
Okay, it's a pandemic. There you go. It's not even a cliche, because it is actually a pandemic. So, look, I can't say I know exactly why that game is on at 4 o'clock, but somebody might text us in 51552. Why can't they move the game so that it is on in Clonus?
Yeah, exactly. We've a Kerry school here getting behind the girls in green and getting their messages in already to us on Twitter, so delighted with that. Certainly in the running for that fantastic jersey.
Yeah, it's great. And you know what, Ruby asked me about it yesterday or the day before, about the women playing Germany and how difficult a challenge it poses. But you know, I was thinking about it afterwards, and just the level that the girls are playing at, and even having some of our Irish girls playing in Germany, you know, when they're playing over there and they're coming up against the girls that they're going to be playing against on Saturday, you know, they're not going to have that fear factor. They're not going to be worried about it, because they're playing in the same league as them, and the same team. You've got Amber Barrett playing over there, you've got Claire O'Riordan, you've got Diane Caldwell, who's been just made the captain of Sand. So you know, it's brilliant to see them at that level. And then you have the girls in the Super League as well, and they're going out playing against the best.
I always
in the world.
Yeah, I agree. And you say it there, the best in the world. You live for those days, Marie. You know, where you really get to measure yourself, where you like, and they can go horribly wrong. I've been behind the
go
post.
Go on, which was the worst?
Well, it's always New Zealand when you're behind the post going, what's left, ref? And he's there 27 minutes. You're there, oh no, this is 60 points already. But it brings out the best in you. And I think, like we've said before, I think Irish teams going out there, you know what I mean, to represent, and especially at the moment, we haven't seen a whole lot of our kind of national identity in terms of sport. I think it's a brilliant opportunity for us to sit around and cheer on the girls.
And somebody will have a signed jersey to wear as well. So keep those videos coming in. Absolutely fantastic. And there was a Tour de France news as well. Sam Bennett has extended his lead in the green jersey. 3 days of racing to go in the Tour de France. So we'll be keeping an eye on that because we have enjoyed that Sam Bennett journey so far. So he began the day 47 points clear of the closest challenger, Peter Sagan, but victory in the intermediate sprint pushed that advantage to 52 points. So fair play to him as well.
Especially on these stages. Have you seen these mountain stages? They just look horrendous, and it's just not one that suits the kind of sprinters. Well, so they say on the commentary, you know, that you just have to, I remember they were saying Sam just needs to get in the time, and you're there, that sounds so easy, but like, you go up that mountain.
It does look like one of the most grueling sports. I'm not sure it's one that I would have much interest in getting into.
You know all the chat about Lionel Messi?
I do.
What about him scoring 2 goals in a pre-season friendly? Just incredible out of him. Just like, I think all the talk, and we're all worried, will he play for the team? When you're class, you can just go out and bang in 2 goals.
Did you think that he wouldn't, though? I mean, he's, when you think about it, like, Forbes named him as the richest footballer in the world, so he's still getting paid. You know, he still has to go out there and do a job.
Yeah. I don't think it's a job with him. I think it's just absolute talent, isn't it? It is, like, just put him on a pitch and he's made for it. So, like, it'll never bother him just being able to go out and get 2 brilliant goals.
Just like that. Okay, let's take a quick break, and very shortly we will be crossing over to Tala for the big game, Shamrock Rovers AC Milan, and we'll also be chatting to Mark Thai about Champagne football.
Come on over.
Game on 2FM
with Green Farm. A quick and easy addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way.
Shamrock Rovers, Tottenham. I have to ask you about that goal, 2011 in the Europa League. Was that a game changer for you?
That whole run in the Europa League was incredible. But then media attention, it certainly was. Like, any Rovers fans or even League of Ireland fans, they see you, you have a chat, and it is that they always go to that goal. Like, I think when we scored, I know Stevie O'Donnell was on the bench, I think, beside Luka Modric was on the bench, and I think when we scored, I think Stevie might have shouted over, Luka, get warm, you know, to him. Yes.
Shamrock Rovers have drawn the tie they must have dreamed of. They will play AC Milan in the second round of the Europa League qualifying at Tala Stadium. It is, of course, though, going to be behind closed doors.
Jack, I know you've been involved in quite a number of big games in your career, but AC Milan, by reputation, of course, a huge club, having won the European Cup 7 times. And there's one man in particular stands out, of course, and that's Zlatan. I mean, you must have admired him growing up, surely.
Yeah, like, you know, we've obviously watched him, and I think I've played against the goalkeeper before for Ireland 21, so they've got some world-class players. Don't get me wrong, I think they just signed some of our 20 million.
Hard, but as you say, the fans are frustrated. They love this club. I've been talking to them all morning, and they are envious of the few lucky people who have a professional reason to get into the stadium tonight. One of those lucky people, Claire, I managed to track down, a blessed man. He's one of Shamrock Rovers' official photographers. He's also a lifelong fan, Bobby Best.
I've been photographing Shamrock Rovers for decades now, and this gives me the golden ticket to get into the match tonight. Absolutely blessed. Talking to the fans, some of the fans who are so disappointed that they can't see it, and it is a shocking disappointment, but we're looking forward to getting some great photographs of these players tonight.
Great excitement, Ruby, for the AC Milan draw, and then you start to break it down and you look at the fact that it'll be played behind closed doors, which takes away some level of the excitement. If you're a competitive skin, you want to play a team that you're going to beat, not necessarily say in 20 years time I've got an AC Milan jersey up on the wall from when they beat us in the Europa League.
Who's to say they won't beat AC Milan? I mean, they're not the club that we remember them in when we were growing up. I mean, they're finishing mid-table, all right, mid-table in the Serie A, but they're not the prolific side of Ruud Gullit, Frank Rijkaard, Van Basten, those great players that we remember. All right, Zlatan is there, but It's not the AC Milan of old.
To all of you, I only have one thing to say. I'm not like you, because I'm not you. I am Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and I am just warming up.
Now, lots of excitement. That game is due to kick off at 7 o'clock. Shamrock Rovers hosting AC Milan in a very glamorous tie. And I think everybody is pretty excited about seeing Zlatan. I haven't seen the team news yet, so I'm looking forward to see if he is playing. Now, turning our attention to football matters off the pitch, it's time to talk about Champagne Football, a fantastic book written by Mark Tighe and Paul Roan, detailing the rise and fall of John Delaney, the former CEO of the FAI. And I am delighted to say that Mark joins us now. Mark, first of all, I just want to say congratulations on the book. I think everybody I know is reading it right now. It's a real page turner. You've had so much stories. There's so many stories in it and just so much detail. Was it difficult to get all of that information out of people?
Yeah, it was. It helped the people. You could see the journalism we did in the Sunday Times, and we protected our sources, you know. And so there was, and then the more and more people that talked to us, some of them would let others know that, you know, like senior people in the FAI or junior staff, that I've spoken to Mark and, you know, I can trust them, or I've spoken to Paul and you can trust them. And so it was kind of a positive chain effect, you know, and people would recommend, oh, you should talk to Mark, tell him that story, tell him what happened to you. And so that was brilliant as a journalist, you know, to have those doors open. And also, like, with Penguin commissioning us to do the book, you know, my first book, so to have the time, I took 4 weeks holidays actually, and some unpaid leave then recently, and just to have the time to go off and do that, you know, gumshoe journalism, travel around the country, meet people in hotels. Before COVID, thankfully, we got the bulk of it done. That was fantastic to have that scope to really dig deep into the story.
Mark, as a journalist, do you get spooked when you hear things like injunctions or, you know, the threats, or do you know that you're actually walking towards the fire there, that you're getting to the heart of it?
Oh, completely, yeah. Like, unfortunately, any journalist in Dublin or in Ireland will tell you that, or anyone involved in broadcasting will tell you that the legal system here is not set up in favour of journalism and, you know, even kind of strong critique or comments, you know. So once you hear that the lawyers are getting involved and people are reaching for lawyers, it does cause the stomach acid to rise up and cause the nerves. And yeah, like going back to March last year, when kind of this whole thing kicked off, when I heard that John Delaney's bringing it to the High Court.
Mark, the line actually in the book is one that stands out to me. You had left work a little bit earlier and you got home and you're after getting a new blue jumper. It's like all of it stuck with you. And then we were pulling on the blue jumper,
hoodie,
got the phone call, yeah, and got the phone call. And I'd say it was just that feeling of, okay, we're heading to the High Court now. What does that mean?
I was just leaving work, it was my birthday, and I had my wife and my kids had bought me a blue hoodie. And we call it the lucky blue hoodie now because we know what happened after. But so, yeah, because me and Hugh Hannigan, who's our legal manager in News Ireland, he's big into his running, and he turned up in a tracksuit, and we were racing down to the forecourt in a taxi, and it led us off the junction there, and we had to, like, peg it around the corner, and we were rattling the gates to get in at 6 p.m. on a Saturday, on St. Patrick's weekend. St. Patrick's Day was the following day. The town is set up for the parade, and we go in, and there's John Delaney suited and booted with his team of lawyers, you know, and he just kind of deigned to look at me for a second, then looked away very quickly once we got in, and we were handed these documents, you know, saying, I've breached his privacy, I've intruded into his family law divorce action, he's suing me for a breach of privacy. And you're like, oh my god.
Were you really worried at that stage?
Oh, very, very much so. You know, we didn't even get a chance to discuss, you know, the Sunday Times are going to represent me here. I'm, you know, because he named me as a defendant personally. But like Frank Fitzgibbon, my editor, just give him huge credit, because he had a call to make that afternoon. You know, we had very little notice that he was going to court, and Frank said, look, I'm going to back you, we're going to go to war on this one. We're happy with our fact. We'd spent over 2 weeks working on what was a tip-off about the 100K, and we were happy that it was 100%. So we were saying, look, we don't care about, like, John Delaney's whole action was that we had breached his divorce proceedings, that we basically, his lawyer said it was like rifling through his the court documents and breaching the in-camera rule. And we were like, it was nothing to do with this. It's just about a transaction between the Football Association of Ireland, which has got 50 million euro from the state over the last 10 years, and money being paid in and out to John Delaney. And thankfully, the judge agreed with us. Judge Anthony Barr said, yeah, any payment like that is of significant public interest, and also, why have you delayed it for 15 days of, you know, the first notification? That was key the judge found, you know, that I'd emailed John Delaney and the FAI on the 1st of March, and then on the 16th of March, 15 days later, was the first time he'd taken legal action.
What struck me about that around that time, so there was your story obviously at the start, and then there was the Gibraltar game and all the speculation about the statement that was due to come out over the game, and there's that, which I think is an iconic picture now of John Delaney with VIP exit over his head, he just happened to be caught in the frame of a door. But it all seemed to unravel very slowly, Mark. You know, when you think about, okay, there was those events, but it took a very long time for him to eventually step away. There was a lot of stories published in your paper and in elsewhere as well, and it just seemed that it wasn't just there was no ripping off the band-aid, you know, it took quite a while. Well,
definitely, yeah, because like John Delaney had been there almost 15 years when this happened, you know, no one would have imagined that he was soon heading off into the sunset, you know. And so the first story all revealed was that there was a 100,000 payment by John Delaney into the FAI. So people were saying, well, look, he's helping out the association, that's a good thing. And what we believed was that, well, one, that should have been declared in the company accounts, but two, it shows that what John Delaney has been saying, that the FAI's finances are in good shape and that they'll be debt-free by 2020, it's a complete mirage.
That was almost a tagline, wasn't it? We've heard it so often.
It was a mantra he repeated over and over. So that's what we were getting at. But then there was this beneficial effect from getting that story out there, and you know, the fact that he actually took the injunction and failed was such an own goal, but it proved our bona fides that we'd stand up to him. And there was John Delaney had a lot of friends in the media and spoke to so many staff and people who turned into whistleblowers that said, you know, I couldn't trust other people, I couldn't go to anyone, I didn't know where to go with the information that we had about concerns we had about the FAI's finances. But when, you know, when they saw that we would go to the High Court and defend an action and win, they trusted us then. So it was symbolic. I write about this in the book, that I was at the St. Patrick's Day Parade with my family and my phone was buzzing, and one particular contact stood out wanting to meet the next day, and that turned into a very beneficial contact, and that's where we got the rent story. You know, the fact that John Delaney's rent had been paid over the previous 10 years to reach the level of 36,000, 39,000 euro a year on top of his 360,000 euro a year salary. So we managed to get that story out within the night of the Gibraltar game. It came out the Sunday after, and they knew we were doing that story, and people were saying to me, oh, you're just sitting on a big archive of bleak material here and drip feeding it out there. But that wasn't the case at all. It was, you know, week to week we were struggling to get you know, the next lead and the next story, and say, well, look, there's more to come. And but we had to get to a certain threshold, because going back to the legal situation, if you know, if you don't have your I's dotted and T's crossed and your sources to back you up, you will be sued to within an inch of your life.
Mark, you mentioned the rent there, but the personal expenses, it's actually quite frightening when you read the book, isn't it?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, because it was such a bone of contention for Irish fans, you know, that John Delaney was on 360 grand a year. But then on top of that, we've got the personal expenses. What COSI have found, the auditors sent in by the external auditor sent in by Sport Ireland, found that John Delaney had spent €500,000 on his FAI credit card over 5 years. But a lot of that was on the FAI business. But what the FAI had estimated themselves, having looked at it, was that €125,000 of that had gone on personal expenditure on behalf of John Delaney, including €50,000 in cash withdrawals.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And, you know, it's something John Delaney still hasn't answered for. Obviously, there's an ongoing Garda investigation. The Office of Director of Corporate Enforcement are in the High Court at the moment. They've done a search on Abbottstown. They've seized John Delaney's email, and they want to trawl through that. And there's a process on at the moment where John Delaney has to set out which emails he says are private or are legally privileged.
There is so much about his excessive spending and just so many different stories and revelations in the book. And you were a centre of a lot of that, because a lot of it you uncovered. What shocked you the most?
What shocked me really, yeah, as well as the finances, like the headline that COSI found was that the total personal expenditure on John Delaney's behalf over the last 5 years was just over €700,000. So John Delaney in the last few years started repaying money into the FAI. Like they paid his rent for 2 years when it wasn't even in his contract, up from 2015 and 2016. So those numbers were jaw-dropping and alone. But what... There were so many things. the other thing was that the use of credit cards in the FAI, there was a culture of credit card use, and not for just personal expenditure, but just for everyday finances.
There was loads of them, wasn't there?
Yeah, so they had over 60 credit cards. There was €2 million put through the credit cards on average each year. So instead of you know, normal procurement, so our company does something for the FAI and sends in an invoice. No, they stick it on the credit card. And this is obviously because what Cosi found is because that the FAI was flat broke and they didn't have the money in their overdraft, didn't have the money in their bank account, so they were using credit cards to ensure the FAI didn't go insolvent. And this is something that, you know, was a norm in the FAI over the years. So when John Delaney went into the Oireachtas hearing last year and said, you know, if only the finance department had come to me earlier, you know, I could have, you know, if I couldn't foresee this, you know, how bad the FAI's finances were, I wouldn't have had to pay that 100 grand in and all the mess that that caused. But, you know, what Cosi found was that the emails are going to John Delaney. He knew that the FAI's finances were in bad shape. He knew he was intimately involved in what was happening with the FAI's finances, and he knew how bad it was, how close they were to breaching their overdraft so many times.
Mark, sometimes in Irish culture we love a rogue, a bit of a chancer, but this is so frustrating when you see the state of the FAI and, you know, it needing to be bailed out and needing to be looked after.
Yeah, so the state has bailed out the FAI. This is, you know, so it's not funny. It's this is taxpayers' money. This is you know, badly needed money that's got been pumped into the FAI now to keep it solvent. You know, they've got over 7.6 million interest-free loan. They've doubled their grant to 5.9 million euro a year from Support Ireland. And but yeah, there's still people that are very loyal to John Delaney. You know, people have compared him to Donald Trump, and I suppose he took care of the grassroots. You know, he gave them what they wanted. You know, he spoke to them, he visited them personally, he had that personal touch. He flashed the checkbook, he'd give them 5 grand, 10 grand match tickets, jerseys, whatever you're having yourself. And there are people that remain to this day extremely loyal to John Delaney.
I've been at FAI events where I've seen him get standing ovations. You know, it's just this outpouring of support for one man, like, you know, just like he is the leader and that's it. But
there was a cult about him eventually, yeah.
That has changed quite a bit since then. Now, the credit union ads, now, they have got a lot of attention since the book has been released, because, of course, it's Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane, and an ill-fated credit union ad that ended up costing a huge amount of money to the FAI. Have you seen the ad?
Yeah, I've seen the ads.
Where is the ad? I'm surprised it hasn't leaked.
They leaked in that I was able to see them. We describe one of them in the book, which is you know, where Roy Keane is a Zen master clipping at a bonsai tree while Martin O'Neill is bungling around there banging his knee. So these were two ads shot by Roy Keane and Martin O'Neill, and the Bohemians were involved, the Bohemians FC in Dublin. I could see some of the players were going, I thought it was because I was a bad actor, the ads never aired. But what actually happened was the FAI and John Delaney said they agreed this deal with the credit union. They took half the money up front, basically 100 grand or more. They could have more than increased that, more than doubled it if Ireland had qualified for Euro 2016. But Martin O'Neill didn't like the scripts, and he didn't want to do the ads, but he was persuaded to do the ads. You have a veto over them, and you know, it was a nice example, a vignette, an example of the mismanagement that went on, you know, that normal procurement or sales or sponsorship deals weren't agreed on. You know, there was a lot of haphazard deals like this. And so what happened was, you know, it got to a stage where the credit unions were threatening to run the ads, and the FAI were saying, we're going to have to injunct you because Martin O'Neill, we're afraid Martin O'Neill could even quit here. And, you know, I don't blame Martin O'Neill for this. You know, he didn't want to do the ads. You know, he kind of had his arm twisted, but he was given a guarantee of veto, and he used that. And at the end of the day, the FAI folded in terms of they paid up, they paid the money back and paid the expenses that the FAI incurred in, sorry, that the credit unions incurred in booking the ads to go run on television and all the production costs that went with it.
We kind of laugh about things like that, but when you mention the money that it cost and the money that was lost because of it, and then you think of the amount of people who were working in the FAI and may have lost their jobs along the way as well, you know, that it's actually, there's a stark reality there that a lot of people suffered consequences because of things like that.
Yeah, so like the FAI staff, depending on what grade they were, they suffered very serious pay reductions in 2010, 2012, up to 2012 of 10-15%, and some of them are only getting those pay restorations now. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, a lot of people have quit the FAI who are in good positions, who just weren't happy with obviously the pay reductions and also how the place was being run. So yeah, a lot of careers have been affected by the mismanagement, and I suppose the investment in the grassroots has suffered hugely. You know, okay, clubs have got their checks here and there, but a lot of the clubs actually were promised checks recently, haven't got their checks, like Leixlip United being one example that we've highlighted in the book, you know, despite it being promised, you know, when John Delaney was there. So like the debt the FAI have incurred now and the new loans they've had to take out, like over 24 million extra in loans from Bank of Ireland, these are debts that Irish football will be paying off for decades.
Mark, when you look at Diego and it just maybe seeking the limelight, you mentioned Moscow in 2021 and you look at the Euros in 2012, just, you know, spending the time with the fans and the expenses there.
Yeah, I think John Delaney, you know, he had this desire to be loved by all kind of the strands of what he called the football family. And the one, you know, it worked with the grassroots to a certain extent. He got a lot of sponsors on board, you know, some of the managers. But, you know, he couldn't win over the fans, you know. There was a certain clique of fans that were very loyal to him up to the end. You know, when we talk about, you know, Aarhus, you know, where it was very bitter exchanges at the time, at the end of Martin O'Neill campaign, you know, there's a lot of Delaney out banners, but then people, you know, almost coming to blows there, you know, trying to defend John's honour. So there were fans that were very loyal to him that he did win over, and, you know, he'd often go and buy pints for the fans and help them get tickets, or, you know, there's even an occasion where there was a behind the doors international match between Ireland, not a full match, between Ireland and Northern Ireland, and John Delaney got some of the big fans that were fans of his, got them into the ball boys during the match, you know. So this is how he looked after people and inspired, you know, great confidence and support and loyalty from them.
It was almost like a politician would.
Completely like a politician. And you could see even how he boasted about that. Like, there was a Barry Egan documentary done on The Independent, and just, you know, example of one person in the media who was a big fan of his. But in that, you know, he boasted about how Fianna Fáil had asked him to run for them. And he definitely had the politician's touch. You know, he'd ring five members of the grassroots going up to Dublin and five members coming back down, even in the early days when he was still based in Waterford. So he was always tending the grassroots, even though he was an executive, you know. So there should be this divide, but the FAI is a bit like the GAA, you know, like they have their version of the Congress, which is their council and their AGM where stuff is voted through. And John Delaney always had one eye on those votes and how things would be changed, and where the power actually lay was with the grassroots and amateur football.
Did you have much dealings with him?
Through the years, my co-author would have had a few more dealings. Like, I remember in 2016, I was trying to ask him some questions about the FAI's finances, and it was a brand launch for Euro 20, Ireland's brand. It's like the Samuel Beckett Bridge. And I remember I was promised John Delaney would stop with the Sunday section, and I ended up having to ask Martin O'Neill a question, even though I'm not a football reporter, I'm a news reporter, just to keep my position. And then when John Delaney came, he legged it past me like as fast as he could. And so he just had this policy of, kind of with the Sunday Times, of ignoring our questions down the years. And so, like, I said hello to him at the Oireachtas hearing last April, and he said hello back, and that's kind of the extent of our interactions. His solicitor told me not to be sending in any questions. They wouldn't be answering any questions when I last approached them.
Where is he now?
John Delaney is based in London, where he's working. In his most recent affidavit filed in the ODCE case, he talks about, you know, kind of putting his life at risk because he's working in places where there's a lot of COVID, and that he's restricted in coming back to Ireland because of that. And, you know, we did speak to Joe Delaney, John's father, who was an honorary treasurer in the FAI and had his own issues with Veronica Guerin uncovered back in the 90s. And, you know, he said John's making lots of money. And he called us yellow pack journalists and scumbags as well. So that kind of shows, I suppose, that the Delaneys don't hold us or a lot of journalists in high regard.
Yeah, I'm not surprised really to hear those comments, because it's been a rocky relationship. But I always found it really interesting, Mark, just from having known if the football writers, but it was you, you know, a news journalist that ended up breaking these stories and really contributing to the change. But the football journalists had tried a lot over the years.
Yeah, and look, I'm standing on a lot of shoulders here, like people like Emmett Malone in the Irish Times, Paul Lennon in the Irish Star, Philip Quinn, Danny McConnell in the Indo. Like, some of their reports, you can just, and Owen Couser in the Sun, and Neil O'Riordan, and Paul himself. Like, I'd be following all those very closely, and, you know, they were just highlighting this madness going on, especially
they're
at the
trying,
AGMs.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and highlighting, you know, and corporate governance isn't sexy, you know. Talking about how Michael Cody and Eddie Murray, you know, the two most senior members on the FAI board, how their terms had been extended, so they're both serving more than 15 years, and they're serving into their 80s. Like, it's not going to make the front page, but they were very important mm-hmm. stories that, you know, people like, and John Fallon, the freelance reporter, they were writing these stories, highlighting the madness and in the improper way that the FAI governance was being set up, and how it was out of kilter with proper corporate governance. So the football reporters in Ireland were actually doing amazing work, you know, and I suppose I'm very lucky, you know, and I just say lucky that some of the whistleblowers came forward to me and trusted me to break some of the stories we did.
Your book, Champagne Football, it's a lesson in corporate governance, though, isn't it? It's everything that you could possibly do wrong.
Look, it's Champagne Football. Like, it's not a football book. You know, it's about power, misuse of power, greed, and how someone who can profess to love the game and love his country can so utterly betray it then, you know, by his actions and the way you rule. And so, yeah, it really is a lesson, you know, a lesson, I think, to people, you know, who could take a lot of things out of it, you know, because, and like, we're not talking about ancient history here. And, you know, we had Fianna Fáil in government, we had Fine Gael sports ministers, Leo Varadkar, Pascal Donoghue, Shane Ross, they all were there, you know, dealing with John Delaney through the years. And, you know, actually, it was only Shane Ross that started to introduce some reforms belatedly, you know, that kind of forced John Delaney's hand to correct things, and then more rapidly, obviously, when things hit the fan last year, that they demanded changes, and Sport Ireland demanded changes, you know, in terms of what reporting they were doing, and to increase the transparency, because what was so important for John Delaney throughout it all was just secrecy and keeping things out of the media.
Is it all out now, do you think?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Definitely
Volume
not.
Two.
No, like, we could easily do a second book. We finished this in March, and you know, we've got it in as much as we could do journalistically to hold to a high standard, and there is so much more to come. So we'll see what happens with the investigations. Obviously, there's a long road to run there, but no, there's a lot more stories to come, and you know, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens now, because all these reports have been buried for so long, and you know, I was panicking initially when I heard Cosey wouldn't be reported. I was like, how can we do a book without reporting that detail? So now we're putting that detail out, so we'll see, you know, what the repercussions are for that when people read the fine detail on not. And all these crazy transactions that happened down the years.
Mark, you mentioned the accountability and the transparency. Could it ripple on? You know what I mean? Could it ripple further than the FAI?
Yeah, definitely. The Deloitte, the auditors have questions to answer. Senior people, I think, in Sport Ireland, you know, they have questions to answer. You know, the people that supported John Delaney down the years and, you know, helped them in maintain that power, I think, you know, they have to ask themselves questions. You know, was I a force for good there? You know, or what exactly did I do here? You know, loyalty is one thing, but, you know, helping someone who's, you know, guiding the FAI ship onto the rocks is not a good thing.
And Mark, you tweeted a little bit earlier about a pirate PDF version of your book that has been sent around and WhatsApps. And I think anybody who's been involved, Donoghue, you've been involved in a book, will know that it is blood, sweat and tears. Yeah. And the last thing you want is for people to be sending it around. And I would urge anyway people just not to go out and buy the book. That you and Paul have done a great service to Irish football, and I think that the least you deserve is that people go out and buy it and not send that around.
Yeah, like, it's very disheartening. Just someone gave me a tip there. They're like, oh, sorry, I've just been sent this on social media, WhatsApp. You know, and it's very disheartening. I just encourage people not to do that. We put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into this. The response from Irish fans has just been extraordinary. I had a guy on to me from Letterkenny this morning, saying where could he get the book. He couldn't get it in Letterkenny, and I knew my local bookstore, the Four Masters in Donegal Town. I'd warned them my family would be in, so I knew that they'd have lots of books in orders. And he drove from Letterkenny to Donegal Town to pick up two copies. You know, and look, Irish fans have been amazing with me. Like, and so many have helped me with the book as well. So I know, like, it'll only be a small amount of people that will pass along that pirate version. But I'd ask them, if they can support the journalism, support the bookshops, and you know, the local Irish bookshops, so that would be really helpful.
I think they should do that. A text off a friend. Great interview. I just bought the book online right now. Well, so there you go,
Mark. But that's the way to do it, isn't it? It's to appreciate the work. And like you mentioned it there, the pressure you felt putting on your red, you know, your blue hoodie. You know what I mean? Like, and you mentioned the bookshops there. This is a massive industry. You know, picking up the book that's incredible. Is really important.
Yeah, and like, bookshops have gone through, like, they've been shut for so long earlier in this year, you know. So like, I went in with my family with our masks earlier, you know, at the Hodges and Figs on Dawson Street, and it was great to see it there. And my wife was accosting people, saying, look, do you want to sign coffee here? So it's been a fun day for me. Like, today's the launch day. We didn't have a normal launch.
Course,
like, we couldn't have people for wine because of COVID, or, you know, they've given a bit of bubbly or whatever. So we had a Zoom launch last night with the lads and second captains, and that was great to have family and friends on that. So yeah, it's different times, but yeah, like, geez, like the bookshops need support like everyone else, and so do, so do us journalists.
Myself and Marie, we were lucky enough to read it and loved it, really enjoyed it. But can you tell us what section is it kept in the bookshop? Because when you read through it, sometimes you're going, this is pure fiction.
Yes, well, my son went straight for the crime section actually today, and I was like, no. But it was in the bestsellers section, yes, when I went in, which is great to see. It's in the non-fiction sections. That's quite a broad section. Look, it fits into a lot of categories, I think. You know, it's not just a football book. It's a book about, like Dion Fanning very kindly said, it's a book about how Ireland works. And I just think that's high praise. I can't do better than that.
Yeah, I think that sums it up very, very nicely. Look, Mark Tighe, thanks so much for coming in. And thanks to yourself and Paul Roan for all of the journalism that you've done over the last number of years. So Champagne Football, it can be bought in bookstores and online and published by Sandy Cove. Thanks so much, Mark.
Cheers.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Naturally good food packed with protein. Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On. We are getting a lot of texts in about Champagne Football. I think a lot of people have enjoyed it, and I think I said at the start as well, Donica, everyone I know seems to be reading it, an absolute page turner, but just the detail, the forensic detail, is so shocking.
And it's one of those books, isn't it? It's you're right, you're going to be chatting to all your friends about it. You're going to be like, it is the topic of conversation at the moment. But just reading through it, Marie, it's wild, isn't it? Like, just like the accountability side of it, and you always think of just ridiculous stuff that might have happened. But I remember we went to the cinema one night and Tommy was given the credit card. So we're going to Marley and Me, and of course Tommy threw a bit of pick and mix on it. But afterwards, Mick Carney just ripping the ears off us. To, like, how do you think that's acceptable, lads? And you're there 23, 24 years of age going, yeah, that is just daft. And then you hear, yeah, it's like €50,000 taken out in cash. You're like, this is madness.
And it's hard not to worry then about to think about the consequences of the people that were involved in the FAI, and how difficult it was for them and the culture, and, you know, people that would have wanted to work in football and found it difficult. So I would absolutely recommend getting that book. And if anyone gets the PDF, don't send it on. Go out and buy the book. Now moving on to golf, because the US Open is underway at the notoriously difficult Wingfoot in New York. And for the latest on all the action, we are joined by Greg Allen. Greg, how difficult is it out there today?
It's notoriously easy today.
Oh,
we've had the lowest round in the history of the US Open at Winged Foot. Justin Thomas 65. But before we get into that, great start by both leading Irish contenders here. Rory McIlroy, round of 67. And he's in third place all on his own. And just in the last few minutes, Shane Lowry rolled in a 30-footer on the first for birdie. And he rolled in a 10-footer on the second for birdie. So Shane Lowry now tied for fourth place, two under after two, just to three shots off the lead. And critically, I think, Lowry hit two wonderful approach shots into both of those greens. But the one part of his game, when it fires well and everything else seems to fall into place, is his putting. And he's holed two wonderful putts in the first two greens. And Shane, as we know, is such an emotional type of player. That will really get him going. Fingers crossed. And Shane Lowry, well used to playing well in US Opens, as we saw at Oakmont, which is probably the one golf course in the US Open rota which is tougher than Winged Foot in history. So Shane likes it tough, but Winged Foot today hasn't played tough. It's actually been, by the looks of things, watered overnight by the USGA. The greens certainly have been, because the ball is, as they say in the game, backing up. A lot of wedge shots and even mid-iron shots are stopping on the greens and not rolling as they normally do on firm, fast US Open greens. And it's been so scoreable, so gettable. We've seen Justin Thomas's six birdie round of 65. He started with a birdie, he finished with a birdie. In fact, on the first hole, he spun it back to 2 feet. We've just seen John Rahm spin it back to 2 feet also on the first. This is so un-US Open-like. And in this scenario, we could see a better round than 65 today, or certainly a possibility of Thomas's 65 being equaled. We also saw Patrick Reed have a hole-in-one on the seventh. Rory McIlroy, you know, he got off to a great start. He hit it to 18 feet on the par 3 10th hole, 206 yards, about a 6-iron in his hand. He rolled in that putt. And by and large, Rory McIlroy, you know, putted really well. but he also missed two four-footers in his round. So he could have shot 65 if he just tidied up, not got anything particularly wonderful. So there's been great golf so far. I'll give you the leaderboard as it stands right now. Justin Thomas, the leader on 5 under par. He's finished with that 65. Patrick Reed in second place on his own that round of 66, including the hole-in-one. Rory McIlroy alone in third place, 3 under par after a 67. Then in a tie for fourth place, Jason Kokrak, Brendan Todd, Harris English, three in-form Americans at the moment. Sean Norris of South Africa has moved to 2 under after 7. John Pack, an American amateur, he's 2 under after 6. Andrew Putnam, an American pro, he's 2 under after 5. Joaquin Niemann, who played very well recently in the BMW Championship, he's 2 under par after 3. Lee Westwood, rolling back a few years here, 2 under after 3. And Shane Lowry with that birdie start, 2 under after 2. This is such an un-US Open-like leaderboard. And we saw early on, actually, an amateur by the name of Davis Thompson, a Georgia Tech student, get to 4 under par after just 7-8 holes. So very un-US Open-like. Unfortunately, James Sugrue not getting in among the birdies. Bogey start, so he's 2 over par. The last time I checked, Graham McDull was 6 over playing the 18th. And I'm just scrolling down now to find out that he did shoot a round of 6 over par 76. So he's well down outside the top 100. So very, very strong looking leaderboard. Thomas, Reed and McIlroy. John Rahm with that tap-in birdie in the first. He's gone to 1 under after just one hole, and he's now playing the 477-yard second hole. So, look, it's a great start to a US Open. It's just not really what a US Open we expect to see at Winged Foot.
Yeah, Greg, we were lucky enough to chat to Paul McGinley last night, and he was saying it could be a house of horrors, but is it kind of smart by the US Open, like you're saying, they maybe watered it, allowed it to be playable, that they can always make it tougher as it goes on, whereas probably starting with a really tough could end up, you know, just, you know, not being as entertaining or getting people to watch.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that what the US Open have done is they've erred on the side of caution. The USGA, the United States Golf Association, has been pilloried for several setups of US Opens over the years, which have gone to the edge of being fair or unfair. And that mostly has to do with drying out the golf course, starving the golf course of moisture. It has the look that they actually watered the green surrounds and the greens overnight to the point where they're kind of giving the players a break on the first day and see if there's some good scoring in these softer conditions. But the weather forecast is to be dry over the next 3 days, and it's the temperatures will be in the territory that they are now of the high 20s centigrade Celsius. So it will dry out as the days go on, and I'd say by Sunday it'll be pretty, not on the edge. I think the USGA are not going to take the golf course to the edge, which they've done before. I think it'll just play very fair. But we could see, you know, high single digits under par, possibly as a winning score on Sunday, if it remains as benign as this. But if they get kind of really dry periods over the next 3 days and a bit of heat, in other words, it could get very, very interesting come Sunday, and maybe almost like it was in 2006 on Sunday, which was a car crash of a finish. I don't think you'd go that far, but it was 2006 conclusion. I was there behind the 18th green for so much of it. It was one of the most entertaining, if in a car crash sort of way, entertainment. And I always remember, like, Patrick Harrington had a great chance of winning in 2006. He bogeyed the last three holes to miss a possible playoff by two. So if he'd finished par, bogey, par, and he hit the fairway in all three of the last three holes. But, you know, Winged Foot could have a few teeth to show come Sunday, like it did 14 years ago.
Greg, it's only day one, but who are you liking the look of?
Justin Thomas is just looking great. You know, he's a fantastic in-form player right now. Dustin Johnson and John Rahm. So one of the things about the top six players in the world right now, they're all in form. Rory McIlroy was the only one that I doubted of that top six was in form, but he's just shown today that the tied for seventh place finish that he had at the Tour Championship 2 weeks ago was an indicator that he's got over the hump, that he of this, you know, playing in front of an empty stadium, so to speak. He admitted that was something that he found difficult. He's also now seen his wife give birth. So all of that worry of the last few months of pregnancy of his wife, that's gone. So we're seeing Rory unfold into the type of player that we know can play the game quite astonishingly brilliantly. And this is the thing which I always find tiresome when I hear people writing off Rory McIlroy. They forget how talented he is, and that it's often just a perspective, or maybe a mental perspective that he has, or maybe just a tiny element of technique in his swing. And suddenly he's back. And really, you know, that putter between in his hands is a bit like Lowry, the key to McIlroy flowing. Like, he's 122nd in the PGA Tour stats in terms of putting. Now, that might sound terrible, but there are 220 players who are rated. So he's probably middle of the pack in terms of putting. But it's the rest of his game that's great. So if he puts reasonably well, he'll be there or thereabouts come Sunday. I'm just glad to see him right in there at the moment, because he's got off to terrible starts in majors over the last 2 years. There's a great stat being quoted today from Justin Ray, who's a golf statistician. Over the last 8 major championships, McIlroy has been 16 over par for the first round and 23 under par for the rounds 2 to 4. Which means that he's been awful in the first round and yet always seems to play quite well after that. So now that he's got off to a good start, it's like a race where he's up with the shoulders of the leaders and the pacemakers, and he's now jostling for position. Doesn't really matter that he doesn't get any closer to the lead than he is right now. 2 shots off the lead come the end of the day will be fine.
Okay, Greg, it sounds like there is a compelling few days of golf ahead. Thanks so much for joining us.
With Green Fern, a 100% natural range of cooked chicken, turkey, and beef. Natural protein, your way.